All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. That is a verse from the Dhammapada, one of three which are considered to be what they call the locus classicus of this teaching of the three Lakshanas. So all conditioned things are painful. All conditioned things in Pali is sabbe sankara. Literally, all things that are put together, that arise in dependence on conditions. In reality, there are no things arising or ceasing. There is only the unending flow of conditions. But conditions are not things either. Conditions is only a label. But language demands subjects and predicates, subjects and objects, and names such as things. But in reality, there are no things. There are no selves. Well, Sadaloka, no doubt, is going to say quite a lot about this, so I better get off it straight away. Anyway, using the word things provisionally, all things conditioned are painful. They are dukkha, ultimately unsatisfactory. Some of them might be satisfactory some of the time, in some respects, but none of them are satisfactory all the time, in every respect. We all understand this with our rational minds, but we don't see it with insight. And we go on behaving as though it were not the case. This is perversity. This is dukkha. However, I'm already running a bit ahead of myself, so this verse from the Dhammapada, it comes from a chapter of called the Magavagga, which means the chapter on the way. And the first verse of this chapter praises the man of vision, capital M, capital V, the man of vision. It's saying, the man of vision is the best of bipeds. I've never liked that word biped as a translation. And I've always thought humans might be better. Though that would leave out chimpanzees, wouldn't it? They are also bipeds. But on further reflection, bipeds, I reckon, has a fitting evolutionary ring about it. The man of vision, capitals, is the chakhuma. Literally, the one with the eye. The one whose sight is highly developed, who can see furthest and most clearly. The one who sees things, conditioned things, and all things whatsoever, as they really are, as possessing the three marks of becoming. That is, impermanent, empty of self, and dukkha, unsatisfactory. So they're painful and unsatisfactory because they're impermanent and empty of self. Because they arise in dependence on conditions. This is the teaching on conditioned arising, and this is the root of the insight. So none of these conditioned things in themselves can be ultimately satisfying and free from pain. This is what the Buddha said, and we believe him. Well, to some extent, or we wouldn't be here today. The man of vision, the most highly developed of bipeds, really sees this. He sees it with insight. And when he does, then he sees the light and becomes weary of suffering. Now this phrase, he becomes weary of suffering, is part of the refrain in all three verses of the Dhammapada. When he sees this with insight, he becomes weary of suffering. That's interesting. The word for weary is nibindati, and it can also be translated as he disentangles himself from. He's at the stage of the spiral path after knowledge and vision of things as they really are. In dependence on knowledge and vision of things as they really are, arises disentanglement. Disenchantment is also possible. With insight comes disenchantment with samsara. It's like the breaking of a spell. All the unenlightened ones are as if under a spell. So the inference is that they're deluded. They're men, they're not men of vision. Their Dharma eye has not opened, or if it has, it's closed again. And they're left with just an after image of the truth. They don't see with insight, they see back to front, upside down, topsy-turvy, viparyasa. The verse insists that all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, but those stricken with viparyasa see them as satisfactory. This is our delusion, and it causes pain, sometimes great pain. And it causes pain in two ways. Firstly, it causes us to seek security in false refuges. And secondly, it causes us to react to the unsatisfactoriness, and thus we suffer even more. I don't know whether you saw or remember a film quite a few years ago called Four Weddings and a Funeral. The funeral is that of a very jolly middle-aged man who suddenly collapses and dies of a heart attack when he's vigorously dancing at one of the wedding feasts. Yes, death, the skeleton at the feast. And the dead man's lover, a younger man and his long-standing other half, was totally wrapped up in his partner, who has so suddenly been snatched away. And when the mourners are gathered behind a coffin, this young man reads out Auden, W.H. Auden's poem, Funeral Blues. And the poet, you can tell, the poet's lines really speak for him. He was my north, my south, my east and west, my working week and Sunday best, Sunday rest, my moon, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. And then comes the punchline, I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. So that's viparyasa, a very dramatic instance of viparyasa, arising in dependence on, you could say, the intoxication with life. And in this case, it relates directly to impermanence. I thought that love would last forever. But indirectly, of course, it relates to dukkha, because it clearly causes him immense pain. The sudden seeing straight, I was wrong, is caused by the sudden bereavement. And sudden bereavement can sometimes, I've read and heard, lead those who are suddenly bereaved to the spiritual path. So suffering then is a jolt of a wake-up call. Where does Buddhism begin? It begins with an experience. It begins with an experience of pain, unsatisfactoriness, suffering as feeling, vedana. A feeling can't be doubted. One thing only do I teach, said the Buddha, sorrow and its end to reach. But dukkha, the pain, the unsatisfactoriness, is not necessarily always a wake-up call. If it were, there would probably be many more Dharma theories in the world than there are. The Buddha also said that there are two results of suffering. One, suffering can make one bewildered, deadened, Some suffer so much that they're overwhelmed with it. They're stuck in a state of stupefied passivity. Such, I suppose, are the inhabitants of the hell realms on the wheel of life. Those, for example, who are suffering from severe psychological disorders. The other result that the Buddha mentions in this little list is that suffering causes one to roam abroad in search of a cure. So you can roam abroad in search of a cure, and you can find the wrong kind of cure. Maybe you take to drugs as a way of getting rid of it all. But you can go in search of a more successful cure, if you like. And you discover the Dharma, or you discover some kind of spiritual solution. So dukkha is the pivot by which we can swing from the ignoble quest to the noble quest. We can swing, because of dukkha, from mind reactive to mind creative. The other day I was listening to Beethoven's last piano sonata, which I rather like, and it's quite short, and there's a beautiful adagio played, Beethoven suggests, molto semplice e cantabile, and I was really getting into it. I was feeling uplifted. When suddenly the screaming monotone of a car alarm erupted into my pleasure, spoiling it, and activated, unfortunately, the reactive mind. Contact with things we dislike is suffering. That is one of the traditional lists. So when things like that happen to me, I can usually resort to one of the perks of being hard of hearing. I can switch off the hearing aids. But in this instance, I would have switched off Beethoven too. So instead, I practiced patience. And it wasn't long before my reaction transmuted into reflecting on the fact that Beethoven was completely deaf when he wrote that sonata. Completely deaf. So the dukkha of deafness didn't stop him from composing and making his music. Outwardly deaf to it, he continued to create beautiful sound. So that reflection was inspiring, and it was triggered initially by irritation from being in contact with what I dislike. So on the noble quest, we strive to persuade ourselves away from the false refuges of the unsatisfactory. The trouble is, we're looking both ways, aren't we? We're looking both ways. That in itself is dukkha, this being able to look both ways. We are at the mercy of two strong pulls, the pull of the unconditioned and the pull of the conditioned. Very, very strong. That in itself is dukkha. And the trick here, and this is something I think is worth reflecting on, is how we can lure ourselves, how we can coax ourselves away from the unsatisfactoriness or the viparyasa of seeing the unsatisfactory as satisfactory and moving up towards the positive end of the spectrum. So the Buddha's told us all about dukkha and the end of dukkha, and we believe him. We take him seriously, so seriously that we've actually gone for refuge to the three jewels. But we've heard him, we've understood him, but that's not enough. That's a necessary base, but we have to see with insight to the level, at the level of bhavana, mind prajna. And in order to do that, we have to practice chintamayi prajna, the wisdom of reflecting. And there's loads of reflecting we can do on the way to the goal, before we can see with insight that all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, and thus disentangle ourselves and break the spell of samsara. I don't know whether it comes from the Eastern tradition or the Western tradition, but one way of developing Chintamayi Prajna is to try and prove the teaching wrong. So our homework for the weekend, this weekend, might be to try our damnedest to find some conditioned thing that is totally satisfactory. And therefore something that we could go for refuge to. The Dhammapada, in its own words, tells us that not even winning the lottery can give us satisfaction. It says, not even in a shower of money is satisfaction of desires to be found. Nor is going for refuge to sacred hills. Watch it. Or woods. Or groves or trees. And so on. Nevertheless, in spite of what the Buddha says, we could use Chintamayi Prajna to try and prove him wrong. And by looking for just a little something that doesn't arise in dependence on conditions. Thus testing his words like gold in fire. Or it could be, yes, I'm struggling with the time element here. That's dukkha. I'm going to skip a bit, unfortunately. I was going to suggest that another little bit of homework one might do is to choose something that is more unsatisfactory than having your music interrupted by car alarm sirens. I was going to suggest that you choose a conflict or an encounter with another biped that you found extremely painful, and to try and look into that and how much you yourself contributed to the unsatisfactoriness. But I mentioned that now just in passing. I was going to go into it in some detail. Or it could be something that might well seem trifling to others, but it's biting, and therefore it's a sign of a deep-rooted klesha. The point is, with this teaching on unsatisfactoriness, we can understand it intellectually, but it's got to bite. Until it bites, we won't really come to grips with it. Or, to conclude, it could be an aspect of our life in general, something more ongoing, whose unsatisfactoriness consistently afflicts us. When I first started working at the Cambridge Buddhist Centre just over 10 years ago, I used to get really uptight when things went wrong, when things went awry. Maybe a speaker suddenly called off. Or maybe the printer broke down at a crucial moment. You know the kind of thing. Or the person I shared the office with didn't quite see the things the same way as I did. As I said, I used to get quite uptight. And it was like banging my head against the nature of reality. And the order member I was living with at the time, it was Vajrananda actually, he gave me a little friendly pep talk and about this, which I found slightly painful, but actually very helpful. And soon after, I began to take things much more as they came. I let go of the self-investment and the unreal expectations. And ironically, after that, everything seemed to come together much more smoothly than it had before. I think difficulty is a good thing, in a way. Difficulty is our plough. That is what W.B. Yeats wrote to a fellow poet in a letter. Difficulty is our plough. It helps us to break up the surface and start digging deeper to get down to something much more real. So as we learn to look on unsatisfactoriness as a challenge and we refuse to buckle in the face of it, we become much more resilient. We learn to respond in the face of it with something more like challenge. And we've much greater chance then that we'll get a glimpse of one of the doors of liberation that Ratnaprabha, I believe, is going to be speaking about tomorrow. The one that corresponds to the Lakshana of Dukkha is the Apranahita, which can be translated as the unbiased, the desireless. Bhante once used that image of the perfectly smooth billiard ball on a perfectly smooth plane that can move in any particular direction. I really liked that image. It sort of spoke to me. So because it indicates a delightful state of being in which we have no unreal expectations and we can respond positively and with compassion to anything that comes our way. I dallied before I agreed to give this talk, and I would have preferred at the time to speak about impermanence, but Nyanaketu had gone for that, and I thought, well, no, all right then, anatta, but no, Saraloka had gone for that. So that was a bit of dukkha. Not much. But then I remembered the door of liberation, the Apanahita, the unbiased. I realised that it is my favourite door, and it's the one I want to go through. Well, hopefully then there will be no I. I'll be a man of vision, a chakrama. So, just to remind you what I started with, what the Dhammapada says. All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity.